Right, so I'm just going to begin with a little overview of what crises are. We're going to be focusing mainly on, obviously, the cost of living crisis we're going through and what we can do about it. But we thought it might be a good idea to remind people that these sorts of things are not unusual. In fact, there's something we live with all the time, and it's basically what I would call class war on a permanent basis. So we're going to go look a little bit theoretically about what it means to have a crisis in how capitalism works. So the issue is that the basic system of capitalism is that a few people own all the resources and the means of production. And they want to make a profit, which is keep making the biggest difference possible between the costs of production and prices. Labor is obviously needed to realize that profit. And the more surplus value that can be extracted, the more profit. So obviously what they aim for is lower wages, greater levels of exploitation, increasing productivity, and the highest prices they can get away with. So this crisis is really inherent within capitalism, because to realize the profits, they actually have to sell the goods and services. Now, if no one has any money and they can't sell anything, then you can't get the profits. So there is a little bit of a rather large contradiction between the exploitation of workers and the aim of selling what is produced. Now, there are other sources of instability in the system, which we'll see with the current one. So that could be anything that might influence the supply of resources and costs, such as things like weather, wars. There's also things like innovation cycles, as certain products become popular and then decline and other ones become more prominent. And then we have the general role of competition. But for this presentation and today, we're really focusing on the conflict between workers and the ruling class. So the ruling class has developed a lot of ways of extracting more surplus value, and the working class has to resist this, fighting for a greater share of what the surplus value is and for less exploitation. So it could be for higher wages, it could be for better working conditions. So this struggle goes on all the time. It's not, even though maybe in small ways. So some of the things that they do, ruling class does in capitalism, obviously they want wages as low as possible. So you might move production to other parts of the world, find a source of cheap labor, whether that be migrants or by moving, attacking the unions to make it more difficult for them to ask for higher wages. We've seen fire and rehire as one of the new things, and general divide and rule. So maybe exploiting differences between race and gender and migrant labor versus local labor as a way of dividing people and making it easier to exploit them. Also, capitalism introduces machines and technology in order to reduce the amount of workers employed, increasing work speed, and of course, charging as high prices as possible. So if wages go up, then costs go up. So wages go up, costs go up, so put the prices up. The other thing that is what people do is they charge higher rents, because remember, landlords are also a form of capitalists. So the state also has a role in this, and they provide the infrastructure for production and goods and services. They also provide certain things to facilitate production. So example, the health service, education. Education is quite important in instilling work ethics and acceptance of the system. Obviously, handouts and bailouts, subsidies, and very favorable taxation systems for companies, anti-labor legislation, doing whatever they can to ensure the protection of ruling class control of resources and land. So that could include things like police, it could include things like trespass laws and anything that might cause problems for the ruling class's control of their resources. And if they make sure that the working class pays for any difficulties, such as changes in taxation, to make sure that the taxation system is burdening the working class more than the ruling class. So how to avoid crisis? Well, what capitalists do, you almost feel sorry for them, all this effort they have to go through to make sure that they keep making their profits. They need to ensure that there's an increase in demand in the economy. So you could focus on higher income markets. During the pandemic, for example, yacht production greatly increased. Continual growth is absolutely vital, which is why it's difficult to do anything about climate change, because no one wants to reduce energy consumption. It's all got to just change to a different type of energy, as long as people have to keep demanding more and more energy, expanding markets, coming up with new products, building in obsolescence. So there's all sorts of things that they do. Obviously, there's a problem of wages cannot be too low, because you need people to be able to afford to buy things. So they might focus on increasing the exploitation rate. There's also the safety net provided by the state through the taxation that mainly falls on the working class, in order to make sure there's some kind of income for people to keep buying. Advertising plays a key role in making people think there's all these products that they have to have. And debt has been a very important way of increasing demand in the past few decades, with people, because they own a home, they think they actually have a lot more money than they do, and they're willing to take out, you know, spend huge amounts of money on credit cards. So meanwhile, what we can do, what we have to do, is workers are struggling for higher wages and benefits, resisting exploitation rates, fighting job losses, fighting to continue, even though health and education might benefit the ruling class in many ways, it's still something that does benefit us. Fighting for cheaper transport and fighting for a taxation system that doesn't fall mainly on the working class. Also, there might be fights for different on legislation, for example, rent controls. People have also been talking about price controls, workers' rights, sick pay, etc. These are all parts of the class struggle. So what I want us to keep in mind while we're having this meeting is that the revolution is actually the only solution, because history has been a continual class struggle. It's been constant. So we sometimes manage to improve the situation of the working class. But the problem is that a lot of things that we have won in many ways actually benefit the ruling class as well. So often they've been happy to go along with it. And they will always work to tip the balance in their favor. So we have to continue the class struggle, doing all the things I mentioned in the previous slide. But we have to recognize that it will never end until we actually end capitalism, and that's going to require a revolution. So we need to keep this in mind. And I feel at the moment that the general, within the working class, I feel that people have really begun to lower their expectations. So yes, the ruling class has been on the offensive for some time. There's been attacks on wages, working conditions, pensions, and legislation certainly hasn't benefited the workers, and there's been issues to do with taxation and cuts in services. And people in many ways have almost come to accept greater levels of exploitation and hardship. People are just working ridiculous hours, and it just seems people are accepting this as the norm. Political parties and trade unions, not that they've ever been great, but the point is they're becoming even more conservative. And the demands that have come out of what was supposedly radical Corbynism were really, really minimal. You know, 30 years ago, they would have been, you know, seen as too minimal. And there were, and even the Labour Party under group prime ministers like Harold Wilson were probably more ambitious. So the unions have done basically nothing. And we saw during COVID how little action they took. So they've just gone from bad to worse. The state, we can clearly say, is on the side of the ruling class. So many different policies have been passed over the past decades to support capital. And I think when we have this discussion on the current crisis, we've got to think as anarchist communist revolutionaries that it's our job to raise this level of struggle and have higher expectations of what we can win. Because the general mood in general is really asking, I would say, for very little. And we really need to be much more ambitious, I think, and much more upbeat about what we can do, because workers have done it before. We have to look at the history of the workers' movement, and there's been many, many periods where the working class has really come into its own and really gone on the offensive. And I think we need to keep this in mind when we're looking at a campaign against the cost of living. So, okay.
Okay, thank you, Bonnie. I mean, do we want to take any questions, comments now, or shall we move on to the next speaker and take them all after?
Well, I'd prefer if we had the speakers first and then had the questions.
Okay, let's do that then. So it's you next, Nick.
It is me next, and I'm talking about the actual current situation. So, I think you can say that stagflation, where the inflation is rising rapidly and economic growth is falling, is the term that could be used to describe the present economic situation. However, stagflation is usually seen together with high levels of unemployment, and the opposite is the case here. Unemployment rates are in fact falling, with more vacancies than unemployed, something that has never happened in the UK before. This lack of personnel is what is fueling the failure to grow the UK economy. So for figures for April revealed a 0.3 drop in gross domestic product. This Thursday, the Bank of England looks set to raise interest rates again to at least 1.25% and possibly 1.5%, which is a 13-year high. All three sectors of the UK economy, services, production and construction, they all contracted in April for the first time since January 2021. Alongside this, sterling slid, which is bad news for drivers as energy markets are priced in dollars. So this will push up over the next few days. It'll push up petrol prices up to £2 a litre. At the same time, average wages in the UK are falling at the fastest rate for more than two decades as annual pay growth falls to keep pace with the rising cost of living, despite record numbers of job vacancies and low unemployment. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, said annual growth in regular pay, excluding bonuses, and you've got to remember this is factoring all the fat cats at the top of the system who are getting their bonuses, fell by 4.5% in April after adjusting for inflation, the biggest fall since comparable records began in 2001. Average total pay, which includes bonuses, fell by 3.7% on the month after taking on this month of April, after taking account of inflation as measured by the Consumer Price Index, in a more modest decline thanks to a boom in payouts in the finance sector. So we've got to separate that from the actual average total pay. Inflation itself is at its highest since 40 years. The Consumers Price Index, which is a good indicator of inflation levels, rose to 9% in April, a level not seen since 1982. This jumped up from March when it was at 7% as much in a single month as Bank of England's inflation rate for an entire year. Causes of the jump were 54% jump on the cap on gas and electricity bills, triggered by the rise in wholesale energy prices. This was also caused by energy companies ceasing to increase their profits and real problems with supply as a result of the war in Ukraine. In April, food prices went up 6.7% faster since June 2011, and transport costs rose by 13.7%. Coming back to the price of petrol, it has now seen the biggest daily jump since 17 years. The cost of filling an average family car with petrol has hit £100 for the first time. The RAC Motoring Group called it a truly dark day, as the cost of filling a 55-litre tank with petrol reached over £100 and £103 plus for diesel. And this was on June the 9th. and as I said before, one of the problems is that the oil used to make petrol is paid for in US dollars. And as the pound is weak against the dollar at the moment, it makes fuel in the UK even more expensive. In October, there is expected to be another sharp rise when the energy cap is predicted to rise again by at least another £500 per year. This will be implemented by Ofgem, who will probably raise that cap from between 30 and 40%. This wipes out the effect of both the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak's 5p a litre cut in duty announced in the spring statement. The Bank of England forecast that inflation would then go beyond 10% of that at that point in April. And when crude oil prices move, petrol and diesel prices usually follow. The RAC accused the petrol companies of keeping prices unnecessarily high in January and making huge profits in a bid to claw back lost profits because of the 15% drop in fuel sales during the COVID lockdown. The Petrol Retailers Association said they had to make higher profits on each litre sold to cover costs. These rises in fuel and energy will also eat into the forthcoming handouts to be given to pensioners to cover gas and electricity bills. The rise in inflation will hit the poorer more than the rich. At the moment, the poorest are facing an inflation rate of 11% because they spend more of their budget on food and energy. Meanwhile, benefits rose by only 3.1%. Rents are rising too. Changes to taxation have made letting properties less profitable at the same time as legislation regarding maintenance and energy compliance has pushed up landlords' costs. The temporary ban on evictions during the pandemic left many landlords out of pocket, meaning an anticipated ban on Section 21, which allows them to evict tenants easily, is causing concern they'll be left with limited power to protect their properties. Hence, some landlords are stopping renting. Letting agents have seen a number of available rentals on their books halve. This is pushing up monthly rents and deposits, resulting in bidding wars between prospective tenants. One agent said that now people regularly offer 3 or even 6 months rent in advance, or an extra £50 a month above the asking price. This renting crisis will have a knock-on effect of increasing the number of homeless. But wanting to buy a house? Forget it. For example, house prices rose 4.8% in London to an average of £523,666 in the year to March. In addition, in London, the opening of the first section of the Queen Elizabeth line has caused rents to shoot up phenomenally, rents rising by 123% in Shoreditch and Clerkenwell and 45% in Paddington. average wages during the first 3 months of the year increased by just 4.2%. Faced with high energy, food and transport costs, people are reducing discretionary expenditure, and in March, the economy shrank by 0.1%. From all this, we can see that an economic recession is looming. The government blames the COVID pandemic and the Ukraine war for poor economic performance. Other countries have been hit with the same too, but the UK's plight is much worse. The UK's rate of inflation is the highest amongst the G7 countries. The International Monetary Fund states that in 2023, the UK economy may grow by just 1.2%, the lowest in advanced developed economies. The EU member states' economies are expected to grow by 2.5%. So reasons for the crisis, for the severity of the crisis in this country, are specific to the UK. The government has shrunk people's disposable incomes. Workers' share of the gross domestic product in the form of wages has declined from 65.1% in 1976 to barely 50% by the end of March 2022. And austerity has eroded disposable income since 2010. Pay rises for public workers continue to be well below the rate of inflation. NHS staff pay increased by just 3%. Firefighters by 3%, and 1.5% rise for local government workers. In April, the state pension increased by 3.1%, effectively a cut in real terms. The maximum UK state pension of £185 per week for 2022 and 2023 is around 50% of the minimum wage, and only 4 out of 10 pensioners receive this. It is one of the lowest as a percentage of average earnings in the industrialised world, even though the National Insurance Fund account has a surplus of £42.5 billion. Regressive tax policies have further depleted people's purchasing power. The poorest 10% of the households pay 47.6% of their income in direct and indirect taxes, compared to 33.5% by the richest 10%. So a huge difference there. In April 2023, the government imposed another $7.5 billion worth of tax increases, which by 2025 to 2026 will remove $40 billion from household budgets. Brexit remains a major factor in creating shortages and pushing up business costs. The highest rate of inflation for 40 years caused by corporate profiteering and government policies. Around 75% of UK inflation is attributable to domestic energy prices, which have increased by 54% this year, and more is on the way, as we've seen. There's virtually no increase in the cost of producing gas and oil. It is the selling price which has increased, has inflated the profits of corporations controlling the market. For the first 3 months of this year, British Petroleum made profits of £4.9 billion compared to £2.6 billion in the previous year. Shell reported quarterly profits of $9.1 billion for the first quarter, compared to $3.2 billion in the previous there. There's actually a glut of natural gas, and the wholesale prices declined by 80%. But there is no respite for people. One reason is that the UK lacks storage facilities and can't take advantage of price falls. To secure supplies, energy companies entered into future contracts, and they did not anticipate the price falls. So British workers are paying higher prices because of those contracts. Privatisation aggravating matters. In 1986, British Gas was privatised. In 2017, Centrica, which is the owner of British Gas, closed its Rush storage facility. 70% of the UK gas storage capacity, as the government refused to subsidise it. The government did not force the company to prioritise national interest. Profiteering isn't just confined to oil, gas and energy companies. In the face of weak regulation, it's everywhere. Supermarkets, banks and others are ripping off the masses. Faced with squeezed incomes and escalating costs, British workers are skipping meals and the elderly seek shelter in public libraries and endless bus trips just to stay warm. The Chancellor splashed around £13,000 a year on heating his swimming pool, whilst 42% of adults survive on less than that. Energy companies are telling us they have been forced to put our bills up by heart-stopping amounts. But on the other hand, the chair of BP's remuneration committee was to say financial performance was outstanding. So we've got a situation now where there's a perfect storm forming. All these factors are coming together to bring about a severe economic recession. While at the same time, the rich are out there grabbing as much profits as possible. So we should now look for way forward so that we can fight back with. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Nick. Should we move on now to Bill? You're muted, Bill.
Sorry, is that better?
Yep, that's much better.
Right, well, I'm here to talk about some of the ways of resisting the cost of living crisis. I think its capacity is our problem. We've got very limited capacity, and how do we organise with that limited capacity? In the ACG, many of us will be doing that through existing structures. But of course, that has drawbacks because many of these existing structures are just reformist, and our aim is revolution. So if you are working within an existing structure, you have to be careful and try and steer it in a class struggle direction, and perhaps in a direction which shows people that they do have agency and can change things. Because I think my impression over the past decade is that the working class has developed an attitude of resentful fatalism. I think the resentment can be channeled, but the fatalism is more difficult to counter. We can only do that through conversations with our class. We're not going to make the revolution. It'll be the working class. We need to prepare them for that attitude of mind that they can only change things if they change the system. Now, the structure that I work in is, well, one of the structures that I work within is Unite Community. And Unite, the union, has considerable resources and they have a cost of living crisis campaign on at the moment. And I know that there is a lot of money available. There are resources, there are printed resources, but you can organise printing your own propaganda, perhaps fitting in more with the sort of message we'd like to put out. That is possible. In Northampton, Coventry and Derby, the idea somebody has come up with a great idea and Unite are going to finance it. What I like about this is that it shows that clawing your way out of poverty, you can't play the system. This system can't be played. You can't work it to your advantage. It's got to be changed. And it's a crowd pleaser. If you have a street stall, nobody's going to stop unless you've got something attractive to show them. Conversations won't start unless people stop and have a look and see what's going on. And this is a game of snakes and ladders. And you can either set it out on the street or put it up as a mural. On this game, the snakes are few and far between. Are very close together and very long, whereas the ladders are few and far between and very short, each one labelled with a reason why you can't make it. You can't climb. You can't clamber yourself out of poverty. You're doomed. This system is designed to fail you. That's the idea of the game. And different regions will pay for this. So that's one way you can get involved. Cost of living crisis is you join up the Unite community cost of living crisis campaign. You don't have to be a member, just join up. Now, like I say, if you are campaigning within an existing structure like Unite Community, I bring a trade union attitude to it and about how you organise campaigns and say, well, how are we going to do this? What is our plan? Why are we doing this? Not just because Unite the Union tells us to do it, but because we think it's going to benefit our class, and how are we going to shape it to benefit our class? How are we going to give them a class struggle attitude instead of a fatalistic acceptance of things as they are? So I always look at it as in the AEIOU form of organising. First of all, you've got to agitate and educate. You've got to make people aware that there is a crisis and who is responsible for it. The bosses and capitalism, obviously. Not the war in Ukraine, not COVID, not Brexit, not nothing. It's capitalism and the bosses. That's what's responsible for this crisis. It's just ongoing. It's always there. It just has peaks and troughs. We've got to get that idea across, and I think the snakes and ladders game does do that. It undermines the idea that there is such a thing as social mobility. So, yeah, that's great. I think we can get behind that. And it educates them. Well, what's wrong? Well, it's the system. Look, it's the whole system. It's this system of capitalism that benefits the few and doesn't benefit the many. Inoculate. So that's educating and agitating. Then you have to inoculate people. You know, nothing's going to happen to you if you resist. And I think one thing that the Leicester Resist Price Rises has done is to show, well, you can resist this without getting your lecky cut off. Can't pay, won't pay with things like utility bills. This is not the poll tax. But if you refuse to pay your utility bills, you'll get cut off, except for water. But there are things you can do to stall that and to make sure that your home is heated and lit. And you can still eat. So there is practical advice that can be given to people about how to engage and the practical things you can do to keep your head above water and not slip into total precarity. The other thing we have to try and persuade people is that as individuals, we can't do very much. We have to organise. And I think one good thing of the pandemic was the mutual aid groups that sprung up And apparently there's still a third of those in existence. I think if we can start having conversations and get people to realise that, look, mutual aid did work during the pandemic, we've got to think in these terms during the recession that's upon us. There's going to be lots of Section 21 evictions in the areas where our class live. Landlords have got to pay higher energy bills. They'll be looking to increase rents, and one way of doing that is evict people and then put rents up. So evictions can be resisted by mutual aid groups. Life can be made difficult for capitalists to do things. You can assist your industrial. I mean, a lot of us are retired. I think quite a few of us are retired. We should be joining picket lines, helping our in working, the actual workers in the working class, where if they're on strike, for better wages. And then through that, encourage people to unionise, join an organisation that will become a vehicle for class struggle. That's it. That's all I want to say. Thank you.
Right. Thank you for that, Bill. Right. Are we taking comments and questions now or going straight into groups?
Well, if we don't go into groups now, then it will just go, the comments and questions will go on a bit, I think, won't they?
Okay, so let's go into groups then.
So about 15 minutes and then people can come back, so we'll still have plenty of time for a whole group discussion. Right. So I shall do the groups. Sorry, that didn't work. Got to work on this one. So I ended up not making enough groups. So I've had to redo this because
we seem to have been bounced back.
You gave us a minute and we've been thrown.
No, because I did the rooms wrong. So be patient. I have to do it again because I put everyone in the same room. So bear with me, please.
Just to stop us all droning on. You've got 60 seconds now.
No, you're all going to get in another room. So don't panic.
Don't panic, Mr. Mannerin.
Right, that should do it.
Right.
I'm having trouble assigning you, Zach, by the way. so you can do your room. I'm going to have to. Oh, yeah, there you go.
Join room one if you want.
I can do that myself. Yeah, room one, because Deck is, yeah, I've got you, yeah. I've got you there, yeah. So I take it you're not joining a group now because you don't like them. Mm-hmm. And Keith's probably sitting there recovering from his COVID.
Okay, so what shall we take? I mean, does anybody from each of the groups in turn want to report back or contribute? How many groups were we? Three groups?
Two, weren't there?
Two?
I don't know. Were there? Were there two or three?
Two.
Yeah.
Okay, so do we want to summarise what was said in those groups and go from there?
Okay, well, I'm happy to do that for group one if you want.
Yeah.
Some meeting notes.
Yeah. Good idea.
So there's a bit of talk about sort of the closing down of social mobility, tackle neoliberalism on education and other things which previously sort of allowed that. There was a question phrased about is capital sort of deliberately manufacturing the increase in inflation or interest rates to weaken labour in response to the increasing degree of unemployment and strengthening position of labour. There's a bit of discussion about sort of what we could do. This question is, are food co-ops any good? Are they a possibility? And there's some scepticism around them. They're a bit volunteerism, and that it's better to get a collective response by community groups, etc. There was a few people thought there's quite some reason for optimism, despite the fact that things are, you know, in some ways bad, but there is the highest level of strikes for some time, for example. There's a growth, you know, mutual aid groups are still going after the COVID crisis. And there's sort of the breakup of the older establishment parties, so traditionally one social democratic parties, particularly say in France, where you've got the Mélenchon's sort of breakthrough after this. And while all these things may not be exactly what we as anarchists want to see, they're all sort of ideas that at least there's a desire for people for some of the alternatives, even if it's not perhaps things which we'd still have some skepticisms about. And then I think the other thing was sort of we finally got talked about is like how we can sort of organize and do about it. And it was raised about the idea perhaps looking at what was done in the late 60s in Italy, where it's basically sort of organized people going into collectively into supermarkets and taking stuff from them, as opposed. And then that's kind of when we had to finish at that point. Have I missed anything, guys?
No, you've done a wonderful job. Yeah. All right.
Right. Deck, do you want to say what happened in group two?
Yeah, I mean, it felt to me like I did most of the talking, but I might as well continue doing all the talking.
Blubber mouth.
Yeah. I think our group was less optimistic in some way. You know, there is, you know, massive demobilization, like chronic demobilization of the working class. There's, you know, we talked a little bit about Unite Community and how in some places, you know, there might be potential to work with Unite Community, but in other places, you know, it's all sewn up by people that have no interest in it, anything in terms of direct action or anything like that. Excuse me. And the TUC, for example, which has organised this demonstration on the 18th, is being kind of pushed into this position by virtue of the fact that there is a certain amount of grassroots, you know, obviously opposition to the new forms of austerity and what have you. But that, you know, they need to keep that under control. And it's partly calling the demonstration is about keeping control. It's about letting people let off steam and so forth. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't take advantage of it. We shouldn't, like, intervene in it in any way that we can, even if it's just to, you know, talk to people and stuff like that. But as I think Mike said, you know, small groups, there's a limit to what we can do, you know, but it's ultimately, if we're talking about one solution revolution, that it means building something that is much bigger than ourselves and much bigger than something like the anarchist communist group ever could be, you know, it's all kind of a mass movement, as it were. We, at the moment at least, it feels very, very far from that. So we weren't as sort of optimistic as group one.
Okay, thank you, Deck. Is there anybody, any contributions from anybody else? Your comments, Bonnie.
Yeah, I just wanted to know whether if anyone knew any examples of what was going on in other countries, because often Britain is behind the times or behind the struggle. And I don't know, with our contacts in the international, I mean, what's it like in France? What's it like in other places? Are people actually doing more? And if they are, should we be spreading news and examples of what other people are doing? So one question, but I also thought there were more strikes. I think we've reported on them. Has there been an increase in strikes? So is there a sign that the class struggle is intensifying at all?
Anybody? It seems to me, the only way I've got of knowing this is Facebook, really, but it seems like the UVW and the IWGB seem to be much more active than the old-fashioned unions, and that they seem to be organising quite a lot of successful strikes, albeit small ones. But I don't know if that's just... with the tilt of Facebook. Zach?
I think, I could be wrong about this, but I think Unite have also kicked up their action since Sharon, what is her name, right, took over. I mean, there are still issues there, but I think active around our area, and there've been quite a few bus strikes and bus drivers who have been involved in it and have actually won some quite good victories.
Yeah.
Bill?
Unite are actively involved in 50 disputes at the moment. So there are a lot of disputes going on and a lot of strikes. But I think that is the bureaucracy protecting itself, because the pandemic was a massive setback, because their members were in work, but paid union officers were at home. And you can't... Yeah, exactly. And I think there was a certain amount of resentment on the behalf of grassroots members, and they want their wages to keep pace with inflation. And are insisting on... more intervention by the union. So I think that's positive. There's certainly more strikes in the area where I live, where you'd never see any, you know, the bin workers dispute in Coventry, the rugby bin workers have settled and say that they've won. The what used to be the old AEI works in rugby, there's a strike on there. So areas where there never used to be strikes, we've got people on strike. So, yeah, people are doing something. I think now is a good time to get out there and start talking to people.
I think another sign that things are changing, I think there's more and more willingness of actual unionised workers to actually break with the Labour Party, stop paying subsidies to the Labour Party. I mean, it's happened already with some unions, and I think that's a healthy sign. It should be encouraged.
Yeah.
Anyone?
Can I? May I?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, I suppose the thing is, there's the question of like how and where and I guess when the kind of breakthrough is going to come, when things start to come together and there seems to be a mass movement against all the shit that we're facing. And in some ways, like all these different kind of struggles, the RMT strikes, the various things that people like United Voices of the World and all the rest of it are doing, the UCU are just about to, the Universities Union are just about a ballot again for a third time, I think, in 2.5 years for strike action around pensions and other issues. So you know, there's all these kind of fairly isolated things going on, which are all positive, and they all suggest that some people are ready to fight back, people within trade unions, people even at to a certain extent at the top of the trade unions, whether they've been forced to or because they're left or whatever it might be. But the question is, you know, when we're talking about one solution revolution, there seems to be, and this is something we were sort of talking about in the group two, is that there seems to be such a distance between, the isolated pockets of resistance, some of which are quite substantial and important, and the idea of a general kind of revolutionary upheaval, which still, I think for most people appears to be, off the cards, really. It's just not something that comes into people's consciousness for the most part. Even people that are quite militant, people that are really pissed off, want to do something about it. I think we often forget is that even though reformism in any meaningful sense isn't really, it's not one of the available options anymore, I don't think. It's just not there to happen, not in any sort of substantial way. The idea of reform, of reforming the system, is still got a hold on people. So even, people that might say, well, the Labour Party's crap or whatever, I'm not voting for them anymore. I think that the sort of ideas that you can reform the system is still really dominant. You know, reformism, even though it hasn't even got a political, party behind it, like the Labour Party used to be a sort of reformist party, reform capitalism. That's kind of gone now, but the idea of still reforming capitalism is there. And I think it's also in many of the sort of single issue type organizations and groups. So although they might be kind of quite militant and they're pro direct action, they still kind of don't see the bigger picture. They don't see the necessity for revolution. They want to, see substantial reform. I think like a classic kind of example of that is the abolitionist movement. They want to kind of abolish the police and abolish prisons, but not talking about abolishing capitalism.
and you kind of think, well, whoa, you know, how do you think you can abolish those things which are very central to how capitalism works without getting rid of capitalism, without making a bigger critique, without becoming a communist? So I think, yeah, you know, what is the role of revolutionary minorities and groups like the ACG? And part of it is to keep putting, so it's doing outreach, it's doing these public meetings to get like 15 people or whatever, or they might get 50 people, or, you know, we've had some really successful ones. You know, what do we do? How do we kind of make the sort of argument that you need to have a revolutionary perspective, and that revolutionary perspective's got to be brought into kind of every aspect of working class life when people are kind of at the moment so far away from that? I'm not saying I have the answer there, but, you know, it's what we have to do. So, you know, it's something we need to be constantly developing and honing and stuff.
Thank you. Bonnie?
Yeah, I'd like to give an example to back DECA, because I went to speak recently about land rights to a community garden in Hackney in London. And most of the people were young. And here they had got land from the council, I think, and they'd set up this amazing garden. And they'd organized all sorts of different initiatives where they were feeding local people, and a lot of local people were involved in this community garden. And it really was very impressive. But when I was talking about land rights, I was really quite amazed how little, first of all, they knew about the complete unequal distribution of land, that it was just something that the fact that the ruling class owned so many of the world's resources, that basic issue, they didn't seem to know much about it. But also they didn't seem interested in the idea of a greater land reform movement or a land justice movement. All they seemed to want to focus on was how to get another small patch of land from the local council to have a community garden, or how to get funding for, you know, to continue have funding for their current project. There was just didn't seem to have a vision or even an interest in the idea that really you need to join together to abolish private property altogether and to actually take hold of the land and expropriate. There was some talk, some of the people went on about the aristocrats. They were quite surprised at how much land aristocrats owned. And they did talk about, well, really, should we have this situation where the aristocracy owns so much land in Britain? So there was some awareness of that. But in general, the focus of the people, about 50 people there, was very much on these small projects. So I found this a little bit disillusioning, but on the same time, it was a project that could extend its reach. So I put something in the chat about a group called Corporation Town, and they've set up loads of food co-ops in London during the pandemic. And they have actually managed to, well, feed people for so much cheaper. And it's self-organization. It's not a group of people doing it on behalf of others. It's actually groups, families, groups coming together and organizing themselves in a food co-op. And they're small. They're all small food co-ops, but they're in a network. But one of the people was telling me, though, that it's actually led to bigger actions. But the fact that they were coming together over the food issue, they were starting to talk about housing, they were starting to talk about other issues in the community, and they were becoming aware of rent increases, and it was at least a vehicle for getting out into the bigger issues. So I think there's two things. One is, yes, and Bill mentioned it as well, there does seem to be sort of a lack of vision, a lack of ability to see that we could get something more than just the few crumbs people are actually fighting for now. So there is this lack of vision. So we need to be making this vision much more ambitious and getting our vision out there. But involvement in smaller projects and our workplace activity can actually help extend that, because if we're not involved in those projects, if we're not involved in the single issue campaigns, then no one is necessarily going to be arguing that. So I do think there's things to do, but really anyone who calls themselves a revolutionary, anarchist, communist, you need to be out there, and we need to be really pushing this vision of a completely new society. And rather than just sort of letting this sort of basic, unambitious, lack of vision, really quite conservative outlook. And what's so worrying is that so many of these people are young. And, you know, because in some of us who are older, we grew up in a time where things were happening and the optimism stayed with us. You know, that stayed with us, you know, that we really could change things. And we've got to help galvanize that kind of movement now.
Right. Anybody, Simon, did you've written something in the chat. Do you want to say anything about that, or are you not able to speak?
He's got IT problems with that, so he can only do it through chat, I think.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Well, he's written.
Yeah.
Can everybody see it?
Yep.
Yeah, does anybody want to take that up?
Yeah, I mean, I've got my hand up, so I might as well. Yeah.
Like, sorry.
No, it's fine. Yeah, I wasn't really going to speak to that directly, but I guess, yeah, it's like if somebody has all the answers, you know, they have the whole thing worked out, then I'd be very suspicious. But if people have got no answers at the same time, or no suggestions, no recommendations, no kind of vision whatsoever, then I don't think people take that seriously either. So, you know, there isn't like a single solution, because if there was, I think we would have found it now. We would just be applying it in some way. But there are different things we can be doing. I agree with Bonnie. I think we do need to be involved in things that are kind of what you might call at the moment reformist, or, you know, if you're involved in a trade union or involved in an organization, which trade unions aren't even reformist, frankly, they don't have any sort of program reform. But it's like, yeah, you need to be involved there. And it's sometimes very, very difficult to be kind of explicit about your politics. You know, it's difficult because, like, people are so sort of cowed in some ways, you know. And I think people are sometimes, you know, when somebody talks about revolution, that's going a little bit too far, as the song says. You know, it's kind of scary for people. Oh my God, is this, you know, is this serious? Oh, a revolution, that's, you know, that's going a little bit too far, isn't it? It's just, well, you know. But I think we have to be fairly explicit with our vision, with our politics, and to say that we need to have something, you know, more than reformism, more than this partial kind of vision, because, you know, in some ways, people like Extinction Rebellion are right in as much as that, you know, this is a crisis now. We're in a crisis, and crisis means near death. And I think we are near the death. We're at that point where, you know, it's socialism or barbarism, and it looks a whole lot more like it's going to be barbarism. You know, and that's really kind of frightening. The thing about, like, it's true of what he said as well, is about the kind of, you know, optimism of people who are that bit older, right? And I think, you know, maybe if you kind of came through the 60s and 70s, you've probably got more optimism than the people like they came through the 80s and maybe the 90s, right? You know, when I came out of school, it was like where it was the high point of Thatcherism. And everything was being completely, you know, thrashed and burned all around me. But I still feel like I'm far more optimistic about the possibilities of widespread social transformation than a lot of young people who can't kind of grasp that in some ways. It just seems, you know, And it's understandable because, like, what have people got to see as an example of revolution? Yeah, I suppose that's in part that's why people are going bonkers about what's happened in Rojava. You know, I think we've got big criticisms of the Rojava situation, but it's like for a lot of people, that's people, you know, that's inspirational. And before that, maybe for a generation before that, it was the Zapatistas or whatever, right? You know, and that I can understand why people are inspired. But as regards, you know, the revolutionary minorities, I think, you know, we're at the moment a kind of a voice in the wilderness, but that's why we have to insert ourselves into struggles. We have to be there. We have to be, you know, explicit about our politics and to be involved in stuff. It's funny that cooperation, cooperative thing, the cooperation.town, yeah, it seems like they're doing really good stuff, but the kind of reformism in their kind of political perspective means that basically that they're sponsored by Camden Council, and that's going to bring all kinds of, you know, strings, and
yeah,
and they're also they get money from the national lottery. That's probably okay in the James Rowntree Foundation. That's okay. They're just giving out money. You might as well have it. But, you know, you can see that it can end up being co-opted and sort of stuff like that because it's got a reformist perspective and not a revolutionary one.
Yeah, talking about youth. I was at the Home Office demo yesterday, and I bumped into an old anarchist who's been around for ages, and he's the oldest member of this new group that's formed in Hackney, the Hackney Anarchists. He was saying, you know, there's mostly pretty young people in it. They hadn't even heard about CND, you know, the campaign for nuclear disarmament, or the poll tax struggle. And yet, you know, they're in this anarchist group. You know, that's another thing. You know, there's a real unawareness of previous struggles, and obviously that's one of the tasks of revolutionary groups like the ACG. You've got to remind people there have been massive struggles in the past, you know, that are fantastic examples of working class self-activity. So that's another task. We've got to remind people of the past, you know, relate it to the present. Because, you know, they're keeping people ignorant about what's happened in the past.
Yeah, look, I can't remember who it said. It was a Utah Phillips or somebody said that a long memory is a revolutionary thing. You know, if we're involved in politics and we're reinventing the wheel all the time, and sometimes it takes a long time to work out how to reinvent a wheel, then, you know, that's the organizations are not doing their job. That's the job of a revolutionary group or a revolutionary organizer. It's one of the jobs is to talk about the experiences of the working class in struggle and what we've achieved and what we've done and how we did it. So, you know, people not knowing about the poll tax, you know, that's I know that is quite a while ago now, but it's one of the last mass struggles of the working class. That's absolutely something people should know about. And know about in some detail, really, relatively speaking. You know, probably more so than even the Bolshevik Revolution or Spain 1936 or something. It's something that's very, very relevant. Society has changed since 1990, 1991, but it's still kind of the modern era.
Nigel had his hand up.
Yeah, Nigel, do you want to?
You got unmute. Got to unmute.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's been always been amazing to me that in the 30s, people develop the Workers' Education Society. They learned German to read Hegel, the miners did, and they had an education program. They had a desire to learn about politics. And yet in like a post-scarcity world since the war, the labor movement and the corrupt hierarchies have done everything they can to leave that all drop. I always ask my parents, they were members of the Labour Party for probably 50 years now. And I said, what did you speak of at the meetings? Did you ever discuss the tall paddle martyrs? Did you ever discuss the levellers or the diggers? Did you ever have a political discussion in those meetings? Or did you just talk about dog shit and holes in the road? You know, what did you talk about? Why weren't you talking about history? I've had councillors, uncles who are councillors, and I could have asked them, what do you think of the diggers? And they wouldn't have known. They'd have no clue. They had no idea. And that is a deliberate failing of the Labour movement. And even people like Corbyn, when he took over the Labour movement, he didn't have those things in the meetings. They didn't talk about history. They didn't talk about political struggle or, you know, what Che Guevara did or what, as they say, the Batistas or the Rojava or anything. They didn't have discussions about anything. Just, I don't know, vacuous shit about peace and justice. And I don't know what a nice man he is. You know, this is all bullshit. And that really gets on my nerves, what the Labour Party has done to the political consciousness of the working class in this country. And they've made the working class in this country absolutely apathetic to politics. They don't care about it. They won't change their lives, and they're not interested in it. You know, something doesn't affect them. You know, and it's sad that they mistake this. I had a Labour candidate come to my door the other day, and she wanted to be a Labour candidate, and I said to her, when you become a councillor, you'll go for 5 years, I said. And she said, you looked at me, and I said, you never come back every month to ask what people want. Have a meeting every month and ask everybody in the area what they actually want. You just go for 5 years, and we won't see you. You just, you know, so that's not democracy. You buggering off and making decisions of your small brain is not democracy. So anyway, I'll finish my rant. The other thing I would say is that all reforms are gone. The Labour Party's reforms, they haven't got any reforms. They were allowed a few reforms in 1945 by the ruling class. There's no reforms now. It's all gone. The NHS is gone. All that bullshit is gone. So reformism is finished, from my point of view. So, yeah.
Right. Thanks, Nigel. I think people are starting to go. So maybe
we mean.
No. I'm sure that's not the case. Yeah. Maybe we should start to wind up now.
Rachel's got her hand up for a question.
Who?
Rachel.
Oh, Rachel, carry on.
I guess it's very disconcerting, babe, when we do that, you know. I just wanted to say really what Nigel was saying about history. I mean, I know for myself that until I met this one, my knowledge of politics was zero, and my knowledge of political history was probably even less. And it's only since I met him that I've started learning more about sort of political history. It is true, you know, that, you know, I'd say below Mike's generation, if you weren't there in the sort of 70s and 80s, I was a child in the 80s, I was a baby in the 70s. So for my generation, politics have been stodgy. It's just been the bat and ball. I was brought up with a Conservative government up until the age of 19. And then it was Tony Blair. And then it's just been bat and ball. And it was stodgy. And there was no real political movement at all, from my perspective anyway. Not that I really understood politics at that point. You know what I mean? And I was never taught about it either. You know, I didn't know what the difference between the left and the right were, or socialist and conservative, or whatever. Do you know what I mean? You weren't taught that. You weren't, it wasn't even touched on at school. You know, when I did history, it was JFK, and that was the only sort of things that we did. So, yeah, just going on. But no, I completely agree with what Nigel was saying and the kind of everything else. Anyway, that's my 2 pence worth.
To go on from that, to take it on from both Rachel and Nigel, I think it's something we should think about doing, which is why I put it in the chat.
Education.
Because I'm on a Facebook forum, which is for travellers and free party, and most of them didn't know about the Beanfield. We've just had a celebration of the Beanfield because it's the end of our anniversary, just passed, and people were going, what's the Beanfield? Which is shocking when you're on a site for New Age travellers. You'd think that, no. I mean, that's a massive, important part of history. And I've been to, I remember being at a gig years ago, a Levelers gig, and seeing a young couple in front of me talking about that song about the Battle of Beanfield, and they thought it was about the English Civil War. It's just, there is a lack of political education, and particularly UK political education. One of the things that Salford did really well, although it was an internal thing, was they had an internal education thing, which was a booklet, that the idea was you worked your way through. And obviously it was about syndicalism and anarcho-syndicalism. And it had a whole part on British history, going back to, what's it called? Forgot the names now. But the guy who did the train strike in the 1900s and stuff like that, and George Mann. And he's, you know, I never knew anything about that. And maybe that's something we need to think about doing, or getting out there to people. And maybe that'll radicalise people. Because I don't think people realise they have a history.
And show the relation to how it is now. And make that link between how events are almost repeating themselves continually throughout history, and make those links. And also then you can show how things can be changed through social movements.
And just to reply to Simon, no, it was actually the other way around. The New Age travellers were attacked first before the miners in the 1980s at Castle Morton. It was a test run for the miners. The police actually said and have admitted that Castle Morton attack on the travellers in early 84 was a test run to see what they could do against the miners. And if they could get away with it, the travellers, the chances are they would get away with it with the miners. That's actual being put out by the Metropolitan Police since. So, yeah, Castle Morton was the first big test of whether the police could use violence against a large group of people.
Okay, anybody else? Well, I don't know, Nick, do you or Bonnie or want to wrap this up?
Yeah, I think we've come to the end of the discussion. I mean, in some ways, it's more raised more questions than answers. But I mean, no, it's raised some some answers. I think, you know, obviously, it's the need to be involved, actually be what's known as social insertion, you know, actually getting involved in struggles. You know, there might be sort of very low level struggles, either in the workplace or in the neighbourhood. That's my tuppence worth. Do you want to say anything else, Bonnie, or someone else?
I don't need to say anything now. No. Okay.
Right. And Bill's toddled off already.
Yeah.
So anyway, thanks for coming to the meeting. Our next meeting is a reading group on June the 29th, is it?
27th.
It's reading Kropotkin's Conquest.